G'day humans, welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. Here's a dangerous idea for you, and one that's becoming increasingly popular in our economically polarized and unequal times. The idea is that any society which allows people to amass as much wealth as we have allowed the super rich to amass for themselves is fundamentally broken. That it should not be possible, basically, to be a billionaire. That's basically the gist of today's guest, Karl Rhodes. He is the former dean of the business school at the University of Technology, Sydney. He's just stepped down from that position and he's now a professor at UTS Business School. We had him on the show a few years ago when he wrote a book called Woke Capitalism, which was about how big mega corporations cynically manipulate social justice causes to make themselves look super woke and curry favor with the social justice mobs. His new book is called Stinking Rich, The Four Myths of the Good Billionaire. And it examines our attitudes towards people like Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates and Elon Musk and Steve Jobs, and asks how we should think about the capacity of people to become vast industrialists, how we should think about hereditary wealth, how we should think about the growth in inequality caused by the property boom, how we should think about social democracy. And so Karl and I talk about white privilege and diversity and DEI programs and democratic Scandinavian socialism and so on, and basically how to create a more just society and what the unintended consequences of trying to do so might be. Hope you enjoy, as much as I did, the one, the only, Professor Karl Rhodes. To you, we were talking about woke capitalism,
right?
Yeah. Chart for me the arc of woke capitalism in the years since we spoke. I have a sense that we probably spoke during peak woke,
the
early years of this decade.
Yeah.
Is it your assessment as well that that moment has tapered off?
Absolutely. I'd say we're in the post-woke era at the moment. But I think there are continuities nevertheless. I mean, my book, Woke Capitalism, was specifically about the involvement of businesses in the so-called woke agenda. And, you know, through Colin Kaepernick and Black Lives Matter with Nike and the toxic masculinity with Gillette. You remember all these things, right?
I didn't until you mentioned them. But now that you say them, they're like,
you're smiling,
like from a
too.
Fever dream, isn't it? No, it's because I hadn't heard the name Colin Kaepernick in about like 3 years or something.
I don't know what he's doing,
It's like these strange things from another strange era. It really put me straight back into like the COVID era sort of weirdness of all that. I don't even remember what the Gillette ad was, but it was about razors for men and for women or something. Was it a transgender thing?
Of men, intervening in episodes of toxic masculinity,
and standing up for women and stuff,
standing up for a different kind of masculinity.
Yeah, and then there was a backlash.
Yeah, so there was all of that kind of stuff. In my argument in the book, I was never really opposed to so-called woke politics as a relatively progressive person. I thought there was a lot of businesses were just kind of cashing in on it, and that's what I was more opposed to. And I think what you're seeing now, as you know, look at Facebook, who was, you know, they were storming the Capitol at the end of Trump's first presidency. After that, Facebook banned him, and they thought this was gone. And then they had the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, which is their kind of charitable foundation supporting all kinds of woke stuff. And they've let all that go now. The foundation's now focusing more on scientific stuff, and Zuckerberg is kissing the Trump ring, just like the other billionaires. Now, what's changed? Sure, it's gone from woke to post-woke, but the absolute focus on engaging in a politics of self-interest remains entirely unchanged. It's just a chameleon changing colors with the environment to survive as best as they can. So that hasn't changed, but I think we are relatively post-woke.
And I think one of the enduring moments, one of the enduring phenomena from that moment that endures is the lip service, at least, to diversity and equity and inclusion policies within organizations. So there's been a sort of a sloughing off of all of the nonsense around we're going to put rainbow flags in our Twitter, profiles and things like that, and, you know, all the corporations doing all this and that, in terms of being outwardly woke. But I do still think we're in a moment in which it would be impossible for even a Zuckerberg to talk about them saying, well, we're just going to hire on the basis of merit now. We're not going to pay too much attention to whether or not we're adequately representing particular ethnicities or sexualities in our workforce. That would still be taboo. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not that...
I mean, the diversity thing is interesting. You know, I mean, a lot of companies getting rid of diversity initiatives in the U.S. often to curry favor with Trump. But that's, you know, that's happening elsewhere in the world now. And I was talking to someone recently, kind of expressing concern about this. Someone who clearly knew more than me about it. And their view was, it never worked anyway. So it's good. Let's scrap it and actually start looking at what can really be done around the real issues of justice that aren't necessarily about, corporate programs. And if you look at these programs, you know, if you look at the hard things, gender pay gap hasn't really changed that much. Look at the list of billionaires around the world, and they're still kind of divided on racial and gender grounds as well. So,
well, you wouldn't necessarily expect it. I mean, in defense of those programs, you wouldn't expect them to have worked that quickly that they could change the complexion of the world's billionaires in less than a decade of implementation.
Yeah, I think they've probably been around more than a decade, but no, not in terms of billionaires, but in terms of things like the gender pay gap, you might expect that more.
I think the more devastating critique from people who I know who work in this space, and many of them are people from historically disadvantaged communities themselves, is that the kinds of diversity that you get are very glib and superficial. Yeah. So, you know, if a company is committed to having 20% of its workforce be people of color or something like that, all you're really doing is having some middle class, well-educated people give a leg up to other middle class, well-educated people so that you'll have the Indian, Australian, aspirational person who knows exactly how to fill out the forms correctly and who knows how to play the diversity game being selected over another almost identical white-skinned person who is demographically and economically from the same basket, and you're not actually diversifying. You're not creating more opportunity for people, for the downtrodden people who people claim to be caring about on the basis of these policies.
But in a sense, class was never part of the diversity agenda.
Right.
And I'd say that's probably one of its weaknesses. I mean, having said that, I was in the U.S. In Las Vegas, of all places, 2 weeks after Trump's inauguration at an academic conference. And this was, I think it was actually 11 days after the inauguration. And he'd already started to cut funding to university diversity programs. And I'm talking to people there who had students on scholarships that they had as part of a diversity initiatives that had just been suddenly chopped. And you'd have deans having to go to these students and say, I'm really sorry, you can't study here anymore. Or people doing PhDs or people in research fellowships suddenly lost their employment and livelihood because of this drastic ideological movement against diversity. So things like that, that's, you know, real people.
Oh yeah, it's awful.
Suffering from this kind of politics.
Yeah, I mean, that's the nature of an extreme sort of Hegelian swing from, you know, to and fro, isn't it? The wrecking ball comes in to try to undo the excesses of the last regime, and we'd all be better off if there was a bit more sophistication in just going, all right, well, we're going to change this policy. Obviously, we can grandfather in the people who were, you know, came here under the previous policy, henceforth, it's going to go a bit different. But that's not how human emotions behave when they run rampant.
But the thing, too, is the idea that diversity replaced meritocracy was kind of nonsense anyway. We always had quotas. It was the quotas were just 100% white men quota. that quota was in place for a long, long time. Diversity didn't replace meritocracy. It replaced, never fully replaced its predecessor anyway, but that's also a myth to suggest that there was some naturally occurring market for talent that was disrupted by radicals.
Well, I mean, two things could be true. It could be true that there was discrimination against people who weren't straight white males, which is undeniably true. And then it can also be true that the diversity movement ended up in a position in some institutions, especially in academia and in some of the more woke corporations, where it actually was anti-meritocratic, in the sense that if you did have, you know, admissions with universities are especially profound. Did we just get light? Did the light just change?
Yeah, no. It did. It went purple.
The light went purple, but anyway, doesn't matter. And it could also be true that, you know, we got to a position certainly in academia, some university admissions and in woke corporations, where the balance did tip such that people were intentionally, I mean, anyone who's worked in companies knows this, the balance was wildly in favor of the woman of color versus an equally well-qualified white male. I mean, I just know from having gone to a bazillion meetings at the public broadcaster and in production companies and everything, you couldn't pitch anything without it being like, so what's the diversity angle? We're going to need to hire somebody who's they wouldn't say as much, but a token diversity hire in order to get this across the line.
Yeah, I haven't seen that so much in universities. I think there is increased diversity in university academics now. But I've been involved in more selection and promotion panels than I care to mention, and this has never been overt. I've seen lots of moves to prevent discrimination in favor of people who might be from dominant groups, but not to select people on the basis of gender, race, or
well, yours would be the only institution. That would be extraordinary, Carl. Extraordinary, given how widespread. I mean, if there are 10 of you all at the top, and you're all white men, and you're looking at you've got 10 candidates, are you seriously telling me that part of your mind isn't going, well, one of them is a South Asian woman?
Yeah, and in my mind, then it would be any unnecessary discrimination in favor of the majority needs to be avoided, not to discriminate in favor necessarily of the minority, because that is the history. When I went to university.
Well, wait, are you talking about any making sure that there's no discrimination in the representation of the event, of the outcoming, of the cohort that is the eventual result of the diversity hire? Because that's different from. Like, there are two levels on which diversity or discrimination could play out. You've got your 10 white guys, and they're hiring from a group of candidates. You could say the anti-discriminatory thing to do is to be biased towards the person of color, because then you're going to end up with 11 people, one of whom is a person of color, and that is a less discriminatory body to end up with than one which is 11 white guys. But involved in the facilitation of that outcome is a discriminatory decision in the choosing of the person of color over an equally qualified white person or a more qualified white person.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Let me tell you, in terms of more practically, I did my first degree at the University of Wales in Cardiff in the UK, a degree in economics between 84 and 87. Every single one of my lecturers was a white man. There was not a single woman on staff, at least not one that I ever met in a classroom.
It's amazing, isn't it? Like, how do they get away with that?
And not a single person. I mean, I think there might have been a few Europeans. I mean, that's how diverse is it? Mainland Europeans. That's about as diverse as it
is. He's Greek. He's kind of black.
Yeah, that sounds like discrimination to me.
Yeah.
Not the fact when the first woman
comes in. No, it is, but I've already said
that.
I mean, of course we know that the past was hugely discriminatory. Yeah.
I was talking to another friend of mine who was dean at, I won't mention the names, at a quite famous business school in the UK. And when she was appointed, they made this big press thing, you know, ex-business school appoints first woman dean after 100 years. And she looked at me and she said, "You think they'd be embarrassed?" But instead, they were making a big deal of how great they were.
Yes.
And she was definitely the most competent person for the job. So I think it's about, done well, it's about removing the forms of discrimination that have historically led to the lack of representation.
A lot's riding on those two words, done well.
Yeah.
Because the reason we've got Trump, I would argue, is because it hasn't been done well. Like, it wasn't being done well. It was not simply a case of let's just remove the discrimination so that the highly qualified minority candidates could naturally be selected independently, you know, in a colorblind way. There was nothing colorblind about it. In fact, colorblindness is overtly, you know, dismissed by the sort of woke social justice left as being anathema to true justice, which has to proactively discriminate against historically privileged communities.
Yeah, and we've never had the quota systems that the US has had here in the same way, the way the diversity has been managed.
In terms of university admissions.
Oh, in terms of employment in corporates and border, there's been
it's
targets.
It's informal, though. I mean, someone was pointing out to me who works in the creative arts the other day that there doesn't seem to have been a single play put on in Australia by a playwright, by a white, straight, male playwright who was born in the past 30 years anywhere.
Okay.
In any, it doesn't get up. I mean, it may not be a formal quota, but there's no theatre company. The Sydney Theatre Company, when they have a limited number of slots, you know, is not going to some 28-year-old straight white male playwright, and they've got some, you know, this whole range of things that they could choose from. Who the perception will be that they're uplifting traditionally marginalized voices and pandering to their subscribers who will sit in the stands and clap politely. That doesn't happen. I mean, in reality, there is a massive skew the other way. So now I think it's coming back.
Yeah, but anyway. If you think of it, I don't know much about the theatre, but I was recently actually reading about a play called The Summer of the 17th Doll by Australian playwright from the 50s. His name is just evaded me at the moment. And it was the first, it was recognised as a play that kind of brought out the idea of the great Australian dream. Home ownership and suburban, you know, utopias and so forth. But at that time, the problem was that he was one of the first Australian playwrights to have a play produced, where they would always produce in Australia up until the 50s, right? Playwrights from overseas, particularly British. So there, you know, that was the discrimination of the day too. And the idea of promoting Australian playwrights came up. And this play, Summer of the 17th Doll, was, I think it was first published, came out in Melbourne in 1955 or 56. These things kind of come and go.
Yeah. Certainly. No, I mean, but again, nobody's denying that there was discrimination in the past. I think what frustrates people is when we're gaslit and told that there's no discrimination, that there has been no discrimination taking place over the past 10 years. Like, I'd rather people just owned it and went, yes, historically, white males were, you know, on top. Therefore, we're going to sacrifice an entire generation of white males now and subject them to the same kind of dispossession as their forebears inflicted on other people because of the color of their skin and their sex. And that's the price they're going to have to pay. Instead of being like, well, actually, no, it's not happening. We're really just working on merit. Like, it doesn't pass the bullshit test, but
I don't know. Like, I think of myself, you know, I'm white, middle-aged. I'm in a middle-class profession. I'm straight, cisgender. I got nothing.
You're the one who won the lottery. You were born at a time when that counted for a lot.
I can honestly say I have never felt discriminated against because of that.
No, of course not.
It hasn't happened to me.
Because you were presumably born in the 60s or whatever.
67, yeah.
Yeah, right. You won the lottery.
I don't know. I think it's 57 is the lottery winners. No, I was the end of that period. I was in that kind of in-between blank generation that Richard Hemmings
well, that's
used to
true.
Sing about.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, the Gen X. The Gen, what is it? Is it Gen X? Yeah.
I think I said this to you before. I think of myself as Gen N.
What's that mean?
I'm the neoliberal generation.
Right.
I was turned 18 when, you know, Thatcher was in the in Downing Street and Reagan was in the White House. So I've grown up through that.
So speaking of the glorification of wealth and materialism, Thatcher and Reagan bring us to the subject of your book, which is billionaires.
Yep.
I think the premise here is that we have a kind of an assumption that billionaires are particularly brilliant or virtuous or deserving. And yet the way I feel, at least among my peer group, is that billionaires are quite suspect. So what is the tension that you're trying to get at with our relationship to ultra rich?
The book, in a sense, is more about inequality than it is about billionaires. Billionaires are just a way to talk about inequality because they represent economic inequality. They represent it at such a gross level. And inequality is widening. The number of billionaires is increasing. The amount of wealth that they command is also increasing. But they seem to be fairly socially acceptable figures at some level. And even though people may be suspicious of them, I think increasingly so, even since I finished the book and Elon Musk's been prancing around like a fool around the world, right? It's probably been more so. But for many people, they're heroes. Musk has his so-called musketeers who think that he's just a brilliant individual. And there has been, in many cases, either a kind of thinking of these people as heroes, or else thinking of them as somehow the salvation of the world. You know, the billionaires and politicians head off to the Davos along with Bono and whoever else, you know, celebrities, to solve the world's problems. And meanwhile, all this happens, inequality is getting worse. It's getting worse within countries, not just between them. It's getting worse across generations, which for the first time in a long time, you see kids being less well off than their parents. And we've seen no real political will to do anything about it. I mean, you know, some people would say that some years ago, Bill Shorten lost the election here because of his position on franking credits. I mean, how are we actually going to deal with anything that's seriously about the fair distribution of wealth, even in prosperous countries like Australia?
Well, it's going to get worse as the population ages, because the reason, you know, people vote against redistributive policies is because they're old and rich, and they got rich on a property boom, and that was what that election that you're alluding to was about as well. You know, the possibility of maybe clawing back a fairly unjust tax benefit that old wealthy people have in order to be able to fund programs for the poor, and it was political suicide. So I don't know how. I'm not optimistic that we're going to find a way to take goodies away from rich old voters and give them to struggling younger citizens.
No, I'm not optimistic about that either. I mean, I think things will actually get worse, because what will happen is you'll have a generational shift in wealth where these people, these homeowners, many of them owning multiple homes, enabled again by the tax system around negative gearing, will pass those homes to their children. And that will be just a form of class reproduction. And it's the people then who don't have parents who own homes or don't own as many of them who will create a bigger divide. I mean, so that's a change that we will see, you know, in the coming, you know, still
we're already seeing, aren't we, the development of a society in which it's no longer true, really, that everybody has access. I mean, not even a majority of people have access to the dream of owning their own home in this country anymore. That used to be the aspiration, but it's now so many so many years of median income to get a home, that unless you come from a lineage of homeowners, unless your parents were able to get into the market, you probably will never be able to. So now you have what some European societies have had for some time, which is a division between property owners and renters. Does that have to matter? You know, there are countries like the Netherlands where people don't own their homes and they're well off.
I think it does matter, because if you think, I mean, 10th of June, by the way, the average Australian home across the entire country went to over $1 million. I think it was $1,250,000 or $2,500.
And for that to be the average across the country, how expensive does it have to be in the nice bits of the big cities?
Oh,
given
really?
All the shitholes.
I mean, and this includes all homes, right? From every micro studio apartment on the, you know, in a basement to mansions. So that's the average of $1 million. There isn't all capital cities in Australia now are over $1 million. I think Sydney fell first about 10 years or so ago, but then the others have kind of followed. And that the average income in Australia is gross income. I think it's around about 100,000. So that's about 10 times different. I mean, more if you look at what people will get after tax. And that's got worse and worse and worse and worse over recent decades. So-called housing affordability is getting worse. But if you think about the so-called Great Australian Dream, which we're just mentioning from the 1950s, where it started, that it was about home ownership, and the Australian Dream, much more practical than the American Dream, which was everyone can be wildly successful. But if you think about that dream of Australia, and it was a dream for white immigrants to Australia, not for Indigenous Australians, but it was about...
Well, not just white immigrants. It was a dream that a lot of people from other...
Oh, in the 50s, though, it was still white Australian policy.
But this dream is not... Sorry to interrupt. Finish the thought. But, I mean, this dream is not something that was extinguished in, like, 1960. This is something that was extinguished within the past decade or decade and a half, right? I mean, you had huge waves of migration from Asia, from all over the world, all of whom were buying into the idea that if our children work hard and get a good education, then they're going to be able to fulfill the Australian dream. Yeah. A majority of the country has arrived since the Second World War, all kinds of different colours, one of the most, you know, multicultural countries in the world, and everyone's bought into this, and it is now turning out to perhaps have been a lie. But carry on with your
point is that you can't disassociate the Australian dream from the idea of Australian democracy. And as kind of people, particularly first immigrants coming from Europe, were coming from countries that were still deeply enmeshed in the kind of feudal past. And the feudal past was a system of landowners and vassals and tenants. And the idea that everyone could own land and everyone could own home is a deeply democratic ideal that we don't have a society of a class division based on land ownership. And I think that's kind of being removed. And that would be different from immigrants from non-European countries. But still the idea of independence, not being dependent on landlords.
No one can kick you out.
And this being a sign of prosperity, that you have wealth that you can hand down to your children. They're deeply tied into a kind of democratic tradition. So moving back now to a society of, well, we're not there yet, but in the direction of a society that the biggest kind of divide is between landlords and tenants, that's a kind of feudal system that democracy sought to overthrow. So democracy is not just about politics, it's about, you know, economic structures as well. So that's kind of what worries me particularly about, you know, the uniquely Australian context, because we talk about inequality globally and billionaires are a global phenomenon, but it manifests differently in different countries as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think mobility is the thing that many people intuitively regard as being the most morally salient thing, right? It's not per se inequality that I think is too galling, because I think many people, if they had the option of a slightly more unequal society where everyone is fabulously wealthier versus a poor society where everyone is equally poor, they'll cop the inequality. Yeah. But they'd want to know that there's some sort of justice to it and some sort of mobility between from the poor to the rich. And that also, as I understand it, is declining.
Indeed. But I think as part of that too, the political ambition is declining. The question politically of what constitutes a just society isn't asked anymore. I moved to Australia from the UK at 20 years old in 1987. And it was at the time in 87 that Bob Hawke was running the campaign for his second term in office as Prime Minister. And he issued his famous speech where he says, by 1990, no Australian child shall live in poverty. Somewhat naive kind of ambition that he had that was never realised.
Especially since it was only a few years away. I know. It's like, dude, pick a further, more distant date.
But in any case, the nature of that ambition, right, the nature of an ambition that your success and your life in this country isn't going to be determined by the wealth of your parents, which is what meritocracy is about. Meritocracy is a massively unfair system. You know, if you're rich and I'm not, why should your kids have a good life and go to the dentist and mine can't, you know, have to eat soft bread because their teeth are filled with cavities, right? That seems to me to be primarily unjust, meritocracy itself. But the question of a just society, that was embedded in the kind of vision that Bob Hawke was portraying with that statement. I don't see any of that kind of ambition for a fair society in today's mainstream politics. It's more every Australian will have the right to negative gearing.
You see, in Australia you don't, but you do see a little flare-ups of it in Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders and AOC and some of these figures, and even weirdly in the far right in Europe in some ways. I mean, in some ways you look at the National Front and some of these and they're, at the same time as they're being wildly racist and xenophobic, they pander to their base of welfare-receiving, good socialist French people as well, and talk about an egalitarianism and, like, everybody sort of, you know, even Trump is, like, super, at the same time as he's incredibly divisive demographically, he never touches going after Social Security, going after Medicare or that sort of stuff. With the exception of the fact that he's about to pass a bill that eviscerates Medicaid.
And all his mates are billionaires.
Sort of, I guess I'm speaking rhetorically more than in fact. There is still a sense, I think, a sense and a longing for the politics that you're talking about. Mm. It just doesn't seem to have a quorum to get it over the edge.
Yeah, well, and I think in Trump's case, and more generally with this kind of right-wing populism, you see this kind of attesting to these kind of ideals is more of a kind of tactic used to con people into getting votes. If you look at Trump's policies, that's not what they're about. I mean, you look at the great, big, beautiful bill. I mean, what bloody third grader came up with that name?
His name is Donald J. Trump.
That guy. What's it about? It's about increasing spending in various things and decreasing tax for rich people, exactly what he did last time.
It's wildly reckless on the deficit, but what it doesn't do is do the actual hard reforms of Social Security and Medicare that would be necessary, like the Republicans of a generation ago felt were fundamental to the Republican brand.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't rip apart the social safety net. In the way that, for example, what was his name? The vice presidential candidate to Mitt Romney, who was the leader of the House of Representatives, and he was a prominent Republican. Anyway, people will remember who I'm talking about. But he was, like, regarded as being the visionary of the sort of Republican Party 20 years ago and was all about, like, we have to tighten our fiscal belts and we have to, you know, raise the retirement age and, you know, pull back on benefits and all these harsh, very Thatcherite sort of Reaganite kind of reforms. That's not Trump. Trump is like, let it rain money.
Someone else's problem.
Later on,
when you know what hits the fan. Although this is part of this, that is part of the recent kind of fallout between Elon Musk and Donald Trump is around these issues too. So Elon Musk goes in initially. I think he was claiming that he would save $1 trillion. Then he upped it to $2 trillion. I think it's ended up to be about $150 million that Doge has saved.
And even that is probably bullshit.
And people are even questioning whether that's the case. But that was the sort of thing he went in on, and maybe this is why Trump cut him at the knees on this.
Oh, certainly. And then Elon came out and publicly said that he thought the bill was completely reckless and wildly, I mean, to be adding trillions of dollars to the deficit while he's, you know, dilly-dallying around with a few hundred million here and a few hundred million there is totally insane. So billionaires as a sort of proxy for inequality. You talk about some various aspects of this. Let's just start with the one that you alluded to about Elon, which is that there's something kind of, there's like a frisson of ingenuity, that there's a kind of a Thomas Edison like quality, or that he's an Iron Man, right?
Yep.
I find myself somewhat tempted in the pre-Twitter era of Elon to be vulnerable to that idea. Like, the man's got a company that's going to bore through the ground and create hyperloops and things, and he's built shuttles that literally go into space for NASA, and, like, he built the first popular electric car. Like, I always found it a little bit mealy-mouthed when people would be like, oh, he sells himself as a great engineer, but all he is really is a great, you know, businessman or a great capitalist or whatever. And I would be like, well, okay, that's a bit ungenerous. He's, like, changed the world with He's changed the world of automobiles, and he's changed the world of space travel. And so, like, I don't know. What is wrong with my thinking on that? setting aside again all the Trump and the,
obviously he's, you know, not a man, he's not stupid, and he's talented. He was introduced at one of these Trump events as the world's greatest capitalists. I mean, he's not, he's kind of the world's greatest investor of government money.
Isn't that also sort of a cheap shot? Like, it's perfectly legitimate for a capitalist companies to win tenders from whoever they want to. And if they're providing a service that the government needs, that the government can't produce on its own because NASA can't do it as well, then the government is a client, is a customer. It's not largesse. I mean, it's not social welfare. The government isn't paying him money because it for the same reasons that Putin pays his friends money.
Yeah,
like the government's buying a thing from him that he, as a capitalist, produced.
Although I've fallen into this trap, and I think I just did slightly, is that we can debate the relative merits of individual billionaires and whether we like Trump or we don't like Trump, or, you know, we can talk about
won't be Mark a very Zuckerberg's long debate about
Trump. Mark Zuckerberg's new hairdo. Do you think it's great for the world of fashion? But it's like, who cares? Because that actually distracts from the fact that we have a fundamental system that is increasingly producing economic inequality. So the question isn't about whether, you know, Trump is a genius or not. The question is, he's predicted now that he'll become the first trillionaire within the next, I think, five years. Trump's a low level on the billionaire
stage. Oh, totally.
Stage.
I mean,
he's a billionaire.
He is a perfect example of what a capitalist shouldn't be, which is a person who manipulates government, who manipulates the coercive force of government in order to enrich themselves rather than producing anything productive.
So let's assume that Musk is some, massively ingenious kind of capitalist, superhero. Does that mean he should have so much money, he should command so much wealth that it creates a system of such massive inequality that he becomes the first trillionaire? And I think, as much as debating whether we like particular people or not, it's more about what do we think of the system that produces these inequalities? Mm. Should that change somehow? Because
What's the somehow there? Is it a high global tax? Because of course if you're going to start taxing the way that we did in the Eisenhower years, you've got 90% tax rates above a certain amount, then you're going to have a flight, and then Elon will just leave the United States and he'll go somewhere where he'll move to Ireland, he'll move his companies to Ireland. So do you need a global minimum tax or something? What's the solution?
It could be. I mean, the first part of the solution is we need, in democratic countries at least, there needs to be a growing awareness of the problem, and there needs to be a kind of, relatively popular movement that wants to see countries achieve greater economic justice. Because you're not going to get that change from major politicians. Politicians are going to chase votes. So the change will come from changes in public opinion. But again, so maybe Elon will take his money and go to Ireland and then just wave goodbye to him and let someone else do.
Well, then you have no tax base to pay for things, because if all the rich people go.
Well, they don't pay much tax anyway.
Well, in the world in which you're taxing them properly, they do.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So you end up not achieving the thing you want to achieve, because you impose this punitive tax in order to fund all of the redistributive social welfare systems, but then the tax base flees the country, so you don't have it. Like, this is a conundrum that countries face.
Yeah, that individual countries do face. And I remember some years ago when I think the European Union ruled that Apple had loads of unpaid tax in Ireland and wanted to get it back, and the Irish government was saying, no, let them carry on as they want because they provide employment and so forth.
Absolutely. I mean, so Ireland intentionally did that. And there was that the case of, like, France introduced a wealth tax, and then Gérard Depardieu just left France, and everyone was like, see, this is what happens. And I was like, well, it's not that bad.
It's not that bad.
You lost Gérard Depardieu. That's not the worst thing in the world.
Especially what they found out about him later on.
Let him go to Sicily. It doesn't matter wherever he went.
Let's see if that actually happens and whether there is a change of that nature, because that hasn't, the Rolling Stones left the UK during the 60s to avoid tax. That's the only real example I can think of. And Gerard Depardieu. Now I've got a second example.
Well,
so again, it's kind of hypothetical.
Well, you see reverse examples all the time in the case of somewhere like Ireland, where they make an intentional decision to not tax, you know, tech companies or to tax them at a very low rate. And all of a sudden, all of the world's tech companies are based in Ireland.
Yeah.
Like, and so you can see that that company corporations do respond to incentives. It's a bit harder for human beings too, because, you know, they have to live somewhere. But nonetheless, I don't think it would not have an effect. Is the problem of the Elon and the Steve Jobs and Bill Gates the same problem as the problem of entrenched inequality and hereditary wealth? It's not, right? I mean, there must be two different things that we're talking about here. One is our concern that a lack of redistribution combined with skyrocketing property prices is leading to a bifurcated society where there's an economy of inherited wealth and an economy that's struggling running along in parallel. That strikes me as, but correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm just talking at my ass, a different problem than the problem of the existence of a class of ultra-rich people who are mostly self-made industrialists, capitalist entrepreneurs?
Most ultra-rich people aren't self-made.
Well, the ones
most
we're
of them
talking
claim
about,
that they are
the ones we're talking about here are Rupert Murdoch, you know, Elon Musk, Bill Gates.
His father did
Steve
have an
Jobs.
Emerald mine. I mean,
yeah. He didn't come from absolutely nothing, but do you mean Elon Musk or you mean
Elon
Musk's dad?
It.
Yeah.
Yeah, his dad was an Emerald mine.
And Murdoch's
around.
Dad had a little newspaper in South Australia, but these are orders of magnitude billions of times different from the wealth that they created, the wealth that they inherited.
Well, the wealth that they took, I would say, but
the wealth that they got from their parents, right?
Yeah.
They have not just 10x or 100x or 1,000x, they've millions of times x'd it.
Yeah, but it's still through engagement in monopoly-based forms of competition. If you look at most of the tech billionaires, that their wealth has come from creating unfair markets. In many cases, it comes from aspects of cronyism, in some cases, inheritance. In the Australian context, the richest people are the ones who dig up and sell the stolen land that we all live on. So there's a kind of, you know, post-colonial element to that as well. So
the biggest one of them is a hereditary inheritance, right? I mean, Gina Reinhart, is just a scion, you know.
Yeah. I mean, again, she did multiply the wealth that she was much more, she's been much more successful than her father, Hancock, was. But, you know, it still kind of comes through this process. But, I mean, the other question is, even if these people are so-called self-made, is it actually correct to be a self-made billionaire? Think about how much, I'm going to open my notebook here because I'm going to get to some numbers now. $1 billion. Start counting now. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Never sleep. How long will it take you to reach a billion?
17 months.
32 years, according to my calculations. You know, if you're a billionaire and you said, I want to take $1 billion in $100 notes, it would weigh 10 tons, the money. If you took it, you don't have them here anymore, but if you went to the US and you want $100 billion in $1 bills, you could wrap around the world 4 times. It's an unfathomable amount. You know what I mean? We kind of use this number, but it's just a ridiculous amount of number and amount of money. So I'd imagine anyone actually deserves that they've made it, and that it's not something that they've kind of taken one way or another. It seems not possible to me.
It doesn't seem not possible to me.
Yeah.
I might be with you about what we should do about the fact that they have that much money and how we would all be better off living in a society in which we didn't allow them to have that much money. But I don't, because wealth can be created out of nothing but ideas, because wealth is not just the raw stuff of the land, right? There are lots of countries that are mineral rich and dirt poor. right? I mean, obviously, and companies can just create prosperity for people by creating things that people want, and then people clamor to have that thing.
Yeah.
And so they give them money for it, like an iPhone or something like that. Like, Steve Jobs really did just create an enormous amount of wealth that had not been pre-existing.
Mm.
And it wasn't just the wealth of the lithium that he bought that had been dug out of the ground. It was the wealth that was created by his ingenuity in designing the iPhone, or getting people to design it for him, and then marketing it the way that he did. So it doesn't strike me as bizarre that in producing a tremendous amount of wealth, a person would be able to, and rightly be able to, retain some portion of that.
The question, I think, is it actually about creating wealth? On the one hand, you have someone like Jeff Bezos, you know, with Amazon. His wealth is created not by actually creating anything. It's all rent. So he has this massive distribution network, which is hard to for sellers to avoid. So if you want to sell your thing on there, instead of you getting the money for what you have legitimately produced, he gets, in the vicinity, I think, of about 40% of it. That's just rent-seeking behavior. There is no value added or created.
Well, he has the ability to seek rents now that he's built the biggest retailer in the world.
Yeah.
But it wasn't always that way. He had to create wealth. I mean, I'm not going to go into bat too hard for Jeff Bezos, but he did not just go around creating scenarios in which it was impossible for people to escape his rent-seeking. What he did was, the wealth that he created was, I needed some laundry detergent last night and it was 6 p.m. and I realized that we were almost out and I'm going away tomorrow night and I didn't want to leave my spouse with no laundry detergent and mean that he had to go and run to the shops. So instead of me running to the shops, I hopped onto an app, and within about 18 seconds, when I get home today, there'll be laundry detergent sitting outside my front door. That's a value. It's a value that I value. It's a value that he created in his just-on-time delivery and his, you know, perfecting meticulously the art of speedy delivery and all that sort of stuff. And
that's great. And I think because of that, he deserves to be richer than other people. The question is, how much richer?
Well, what do you say to the argument that that's sort of up to him and his customers? It's up to me to decide how rich I make him by how much I use his services, and then it's up to the board of Amazon to decide what his compensation should be.
Yeah, I think that's probably
He worth, basically? Like, what does the market value him at?
But where does the wealth actually get come from? It comes from the people who do the work, ultimately. You know, a value is created through the work of through labor.
How so Marxist
I'm sounding like
you.
A Marxist now. But you can't deny that the fact that at least to some extent labor. But so why?
But
does,
to some extent is the point there, right, Carl? I mean, there are people who are doing backbreaking labor in Africa who aren't earning a lot of money, and they're working harder than Amazon employees.
Yes.
So the value add is the Bezos productivity boost.
I don't really see it that way. I think that's what Bezos has found a way of doing, is extracting more of the value for himself rather than distributing it to the people who actually create it. And not just Bezos. I mean, this is the system. Look at CEOs, right? I think today the average CEO in the US earns like 300 times more than the average worker. Where if you go back to the, I can't remember the exact numbers. I think if you go back to the 80s, it was probably more like somewhere between 50 and 100. Is today's CEO three times better than the one at
No,
that
and
time?
I think that's a good example. And in some ways, I suspect that it's a bit of a distraction to talk about Elon and Jobs and Bezos, because they really are outliers doing something strange. They've built entirely new ways of doing something.
Yeah.
And as a result, they've simply taken some fraction and kept for themselves some fraction of a tremendous new amount.
It's a pretty high
fraction.
It's
actually a small fraction of the total wealth. Like the total amount of... like if you measured the increase in GDP of that is derived from the existence of iPhones and iPads, I bet Steve Jobs' wealth at his death was not that much in comparison to that. It would be
no, and he even broke at 1.2. I think.
Well, yeah, before all that. So, you know, some fraction of the increased wealth that Bezos has produced through his productivity innovations is accruing to him, but not 100% of it. However, I take your point that there's like a structural mechanism by which people who are not wild innovators who are creating world-changing technologies and companies and new ways of doing of living and doing business, who are just basically lucky private school kids who got a good job, learned the right backs to slap and the you know, the right way to be on a board and the right rings to kiss, find themselves in C-suites and are now, by default, earning staggering amounts of money. And I do think that's a different problem.
Well, I think it's the same problem in the sense that you have people who use whatever means they have to take a large and unfair share of the prosperity generated by an economy. Some people might be better at it than others, but there is still that attempt to do so. And as I say, it's also done by manipulating markets. You know, and most of billionaire wealth is wrapped up in stock market as well.
Of course,
so there's kind of the whole casino capitalism aspect of it as well.
Other insane thing, which is that they don't pay any tax because they don't have any income. So they just, you know, the other Bezos, the incredible Bezos thing in that New York Times investigation, I think it was, into the tax practices of the ultra rich, which is that when he wants to buy a yacht, he doesn't pay himself money and then pay tax on that and buy a yacht with the post-tax money.
Yeah.
He uses his Amazon stock as collateral, borrows the value of the yacht, gets to deduct from his taxes the interest that he's paying on the loan, and then buys the yacht not only with tax-free money because it's a loan, but he actually gets a discount from the tax office because he had to borrow it and he gets a discount on the interest.
Yeah.
So that finances their entire lifestyle. There's all of their lifestyle is free.
Yeah. And what it means is so then Bezos will die and he'll have X billion dollars, you know, in wealth. And then he'll have a smaller amount in debt, and that's the end of it. And so never needs to earn any income. And that's a very common, particularly in the US, kind of approach to paying no income tax as well. And of course, the other thing that these large billionaire-driven companies do is do whatever it takes to avoid paying corporate tax as well. So there's a whole, you know, a whole army of lawyers and accountants engaged in tax minimization, because tax, the ultimate corporate social responsibility is to pay tax, but people treat it like a cost. And what do you do with costs? You minimize them, just like labor costs. You minimize it. And unless there is, you know, we live in a liberal democratic society, which is basically a society that manage, in my view, that has to manage the tense relationship between capitalism and democracy. And I think all of these aspects of inequality that we see, and this kind of, these particular, you know, most grossly with billionaires, are a sign that capitalism is dominating democracy. And it should be the other way around. Corporations only exist by virtue of laws that create them. They exist by virtue of a legal system that is part of a democratic, you know, not obviously not in a country like Australia or US and so forth, part of democracy and the rule of law. But it's kind of like it's like a Frankenstein's monster that's kind of got out of control now. And instead of corporations serving the interests of society, which is what they were originally designed to do, they're just serving the interests of inequality and of extremely wealthy people. And that's what I think needs to change.
Well,
and true, how to do it is pretty tough, but
they would say that they're not serving interests of very wealthy people. They're serving interests of their shareholders, that that's their fiduciary responsibility. And that all the mums and dads of Australia who have their superannuation funds are also invested in shares and so on. So blah, blah, blah. One thing that you touch on in your book, which I want to make sure that we don't run out of time on, is the myth of the billionaire philanthropist. It's not a myth, but the allure of the billionaire philanthropist. So as you're talking about all those things, I'm thinking to myself, if I were a pro-billionaire capitalist person, well, of course they're minimizing their taxes. Why? Because governments have shown themselves time and time again to not be the most effective avenues for producing good outcomes in society. So you've got Bill Gates, and he creates the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and he brings a rigorous scientific approach to whatever he's trying to tackle, you know, malaria in Africa or something like that. You know, the counterpoint is, does anyone seriously believe that if all of that money was going to the IRS, that it would be more fruitfully spent than what he's doing with his money?
I think the question with someone like Bill Gates is, Bill Gates, ruthless monopoly. People forget what he was like back in the Microsoft days, right? He was a ruthless, ruthless business person, monopolist. He's a guy early in his career who used to look at the car park at outside of Microsoft at 6 p.m. so he could see who was still at work and make sure those are the people who got rewarded. So, you know, exploitative kind of person.
That's not exploitative.
Yes,
that's rewarding hard work.
It's rewarding people who, it's rewarding people who give up their lives and sacrifice their families for their work.
Here, here. Get out the whip.
We'll have to disagree on that one.
I mean, who else are you going to promote? The people who leave early?
The people who, not the people who leave early, people who stay late to, you know, kiss the boss's ass aren't the ones who should get promoted. Because what would happen in that environment? You'd make sure your car was still there while you're in your office in those days. I don't know, playing Pac-Man or Snake on your phone or something, you know. So I don't think that.
Or you'd get the bus home and leave your car in the car park if you were clever.
So I don't think that's necessarily true, but very, very ruthless. His monopoly behavior was obviously came under extreme scrutiny in the courts, and he seemed to get away with that. And he became at one point the richest man in the world. All of a sudden, he kind of reinvents himself as a kind of avuncular savior of humankind with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It strikes me that this is just this constant desire for more and more power. He released two books a few years ago, one book after the other. The first one, I can't remember which order, but one of them was about how to solve, you know, the world health crisis. He knew that, completely unqualified. The second one was how to prevent ever having future pandemics. He knew the answer to that too. This is about individual people who think they have some godlike capacity to do things that other people won't do. Why should the world rely on a single private individual with zero public accountability to solve the world's health crisis, instead of relying on more democratically agreed and negotiated ways? And maybe governments aren't the most efficient. But that's also a bit of a myth too. I've spent a lot of time studying corporations. Trust me, they waste a lot of money as well. They're just not necessarily held up for it. And in any case, if government's not working well, then reform government, not replace it with something worse.
I mean, yes, it is interesting. The question of whether or not government is working and can work can become a little bit sort of, I don't know, idealistic. It's like, in an ideal world, we would not have Bill Gates solving the world's pandemic problems. We would live in a stable, sane, we would have a demos that is rational, and we would have a polity that's reactive to that demos. But we don't live in that world, right? Like, we live in a world in which either Bill Gates spends his money on good things or he spends it on bad things. And who is he to write the book about pandemics? A very clever polymathic guy who was very successful in a range of fields. Why not?
Because I don't think he has been. I mean, he was successful in business, and a lot of his ideas were, reportedly taken from elsewhere as well. But whether the system works or not, you know, last year I was very ill. I walked into the hospital, RPA in Camperdown, and I was immediately seen. I received the best treatment possible. And I was put on a road to recovery, which took some time. That seems to me a system that worked. If I was in a more capitalist, purely capitalist system like the US, I would have probably had to sell my house for that treatment or go bankrupt.
You wouldn't, because you're a university professor, so you'd have private health
insurance.
Health insurance.
But still, this seemed to me to be a system, irrespective of who I was, I would have received the same treatment. That seems to me a system that works. So this idea that the system doesn't work, again, then I remember I remember when I was in the UK in the 80s, Thatcher was privatizing everything because it was going to become more efficient. Have you used any public services in the UK recently that are run by private corporations?
Yeah.
They've been left to rot. They don't work. You know, if you want to catch a train from here to there, you've got to spend a fortune.
Tell me about it. Not only do you have to spend a fortune, for people who don't know, who haven't experienced this in the UK, I don't know if it's still, this is still the case, but when I was living there, when I went to school there for 6 months, and the train was a different company than the track.
Mm.
So I would have to make sure that I bought the correct ticket for the train on that track. And if I missed that train, the next train belonged to a different company and I would have bought a ticket. I would have paid ticket for the track company, but not the ticket for the train company. And therefore, like, who thought it was a good idea to sell the track? So that there's a company that just has to own the track. Talk about rent. Talk about seeking rent.
But then that's also a classic kind of thing in economics, right? With a train track, there is one best way, right? As the crow flies, as far as you can navigate around the land. So it's hard to have a competitive...
bid on the track. Also, the track is useless without the train, and the train is useless without the track. Yeah. What's the point in separating them? I don't want the train without the track, and I don't want the track without the train.
So this myth, then, that the private sector runs things more efficiently and better than public sector organizations, well, this is a telling counterexample that's absolutely not the case. So that's just on an efficiency level. Before you then get on the level of what is a more just system, which the health example would consider. So say I was in the US and I got sick and my health insurance could cover me and I get better. What about the person who doesn't have that insurance?
Mm.
Why is it fair that that person gets ill and possibly dies and I don't? What the question of a fair society, I don't have the answer to that question.
Right.
But I do worry a lot that no one's asking it anymore.
But yes, that is a worry. But then the worry of the small L liberal or the conservative is that that's a very tempting question, but that if you follow it too far, then you end up with Venezuela. And then you don't want to be in a hospital in Venezuela either because, you know, well, why should they be, they should not get hospital care when you do? Well, why should you have a car and they don't? Why should you have, there are all kinds of, like, life sucks. It's not fair. You know what I mean? Like, that's the sort of libertarian response, isn't it? Like, if you want everyone to be equal, then everyone's just going to be dirt poor because that's what happens in socialist countries.
I think you've got to think about equality, right? And do you, society needs some level of inequality, I would say, because that's what means that someone's going to kind of work harder and try and progress and try and do more in their life in order to have more money and have and somehow have a materially better life. That's a very practical aspect of inequality. The idea that that person deserves more, that's moralizing the question. And I think when you start doing that moralizing that they deserve more because they're a better person, then you get in trouble. The morality question should come into what's just, which is about how much more should that person have?
You know what? I think there's a third metric. I think there's a third metric which could help the left. You've mentioned desert, right? Like, do they deserve more? Mm. And you've mentioned justice and what is just,
yeah,
which are slightly different things. I think there's a more compelling case which can dodge a lot of these ideological clashes where you can just say, what kind of outcome do we want? What kind of society do we want to live in? Like, what do we want to end up with?
Yeah.
Forget about whether it's fair or unfair. Forget about whether they deserved it or didn't deserve it. Forget about whether or not this is, like, what do we want to achieve? Because I think there are a lot of people who are middle class who would say, I earned my wealth. I worked very hard for that first deposit on a home in 1978. You know, that was a $30,000 house that's now worth $2.5 million. We worked hard for it. I deserve every penny. The fair thing to do is for me to keep it all, basically, right? But then when you say, do you want to live in a society where, like, the people who are serving you at the supermarket, if there are any people left serving anyone at supermarkets, you don't have any teeth because they can't afford to go to the dentist because we don't have any, because dental isn't in Medicare. You know, do you want to live in a society where, like, single parents find it possible to properly nourish their kids and to send them to good schools because the local school is crumbling? Is they don't have enough money for food? Like, then it's like, let's just be pragmatic about it. Forget about justice. Let's just, where do you want to live? Do you want to live in a dysfunctional, crumbling society full of houses with private security guards behind gates and high levels of crime and in the street? Or do you want to live in a society where, you pay higher taxes? Sorry. You know, and everyone kind of muddles along. Like,
our views seem to be converging finally as we approach the end here. But
walk through Copenhagen or Amsterdam and tell me it's not more pleasant to live in an egalitarian society, you know, than walking through some...
Walk through San Francisco.
Walk through downtown. Yeah, walk through San Francisco or downtown Los Angeles.
Yeah. And I think that is the question ultimately, because coming back to your person who bought the house in 1978, this is a thing that's, it's not really justice. If I'm saying, oh, it's not just because I deserve what I have, that's just me worrying about my self-interest. If you want, justice is not a feature of how it affects me. Justice is a feature of the system, which means justice has to be about justice for other people, not justice for oneself or justice for everybody. That is what justice is about. It's about how do we live together in a community, in a society, in a nation state, in a way that is somehow fair. And that's not about it being fair for me. That's childish idea of what justice is about. It's got to be about thinking about other people and kind of removing this kind of individualism and selfishness that I think society in many ways has has become normalized in society. It's almost a kind of greed is good, Gordon Gecko kind of thing. And that we have to think about other people and not just what's fair for me. That's not justice. That's just self-interest masked with nice words.
Carl, it's always fascinating throwing ideas around with you. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Really great to talk to you again.